Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we've got a doubleheader for you. We're going to talk later with Michael Barber of the Santa Barbara Instrument Group about digital astrophotography and the role of CCD cameras. First, we're going to explore water on the moon with Dr. Dana McKenzie. Dana received his PhD in mathematics from Princeton and taught math at Duke and Kenyon College. He is also a graduate of the Science Communication Program at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and now devotes all of his energies to popularizing science. He has appeared on the History Channel and written for many magazines. He is also the author of four books, including The Big Splat, or How Our Moon Came to Be. Dana, welcome to our show. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Robert?
Great, great. So, Dana, there's been a lot of interest recently in re-exploring the moon after many years of just sitting watching it. And there have been a number of spacecraft that have been sent to the moon. Why don't you tell us about some of these?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So what a lot of your listeners might not realize is that we're really in a time of resurgent interest in the moon, not just on the part of America this time, but, for example, there was a European Space Agency spacecraft called Smart One, and there was a Chinese mission called Chang'e, and also a Japanese one called Kaguya, and finally an Indian one called Chandrayaan-1. And all of this came before our own NASA spacecraft that went to the moon this year in May of 2009 launched a sort of combined mission called LCROSS, which the LCROSS part of the mission was a moon impactor, and the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, also known as LRO, which is currently orbiting the moon and will be mapping out the moon for a couple years, as well as doing scientific studies. So in the past few years, we've had this really terrific combination and convergence of all of these spacecraft going to the moon and really interacting with each other, sharing data and telling us a lot more about it. So particularly what's interesting this year is the discovery of two of these spacecrafts of water on the moon. The first one being the Indian spacecraft, Chandrayaan-1, and the second one being LCROSS, which hit the moon in October.
So what was the discovery that they made?
Okay, the Indian Chandrayaan spacecraft orbited the moon for about 10 months, and it was collecting observations from orbit using what's called a spectroscope and collecting spectra that were intended to enable scientists to tell different minerals apart from each other, because it's mostly intended to study rocks. But sort of just on the off chance that they might see water as well, this spectrograph was also able to look for some of the characteristic signatures of water or ice on the moon. And in September this year, they reported that they, in fact, had succeeded in a very unexpected way. So they had seen a very narrow layer of water, like just a molecule thick, that covers a very wide part of the moon. And this was really unexpected because before Chandrayaan went, the assumption was that if we saw water at the moon, it would be very close to the poles, and it would be concentrated in what we call permanently shadowed regions. If you think about Earth, Earth is tilted by 23 degrees. And that's what gives us our seasons. And it means that our poles are in darkness for half of the year and in sunlight for half the year as they orbit around the sun. But on the moon is tilted by only about 1 degree. And so that means that the poles get kind of glancing sunlight throughout the year. And so this means if you have a mountain near one of the poles, it can be in sunlight virtually all year round. And if you have a crater near one of the poles, it can be in darkness all year round. Because the glancing sunlight, sort of just the sun barely above the horizon, it'll never actually shine down into the crater.
Mm-hmm. So at the bottom of these craters, it's perpetually dark.
It's perpetually dark. Never gets any sunlight.
And because the moon has no atmosphere, there's no reflection of the sunlight from the atmosphere, so it really is black.
That's right. It's pitch dark. Mm-hmm. Amazingly enough, there is a space instrument right now that's looking at the craters by starlight. So that's the brightest light that they get in these craters is the light from stars, which is pretty cool. But anyway, so these craters are forever in darkness. They've been that way for 2 billion years. And this makes them very cold. And so the thinking was these craters would be so cold that individual water molecules would not be able to escape to space. They would just gradually accumulate there over time, and eventually you'd have a significant deposit of water.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a theory that was proposed back in the very early 80s. There's been some evidence from spaceflight since then that there is indeed water at the poles, but it was never definitive evidence. Now, what the Chandrayaan spacecraft saw was water not just in these permanently shadowed craters, but water distributed widely over the surface of the moon, basically within 30 degrees of the South Pole and the North Pole. So, not just little bits here and there, but a very wide veneer of water. So this is incredibly exciting because nobody expected it. And, of course, this is one of the great things about science. You build your theories and you can construct ideas and then you go out and look for them. You do an experiment or whatever, and you find something that completely is different from what you expected. And, that's the great adventure of science. So now we've got this mystery of, what is this water? Where did it come from? Where did it go? Lunar scientists are just thrilled by this because it's like we suddenly have a whole new area of science, the hydrology of the moon, where we didn't 3 months ago.
My goodness. Okay, now, how much water is there?
Well, that's an important point, and I want to really emphasize that this is a tiny, tiny amount of water. So all that they could observe with this instrument was the very, very surface. So they're just seeing a layer that's a molecule deep, or maybe a few molecules deep. And the scientists described this by saying that if you took a football field size of lunar soil, then you could find a glass full of water. That's exciting. We didn't know that water was there before. On the other hand, from a practical point of view, it's a very, very small deposit and probably not something you could actually do anything with as far as survival. But from the scientific point of view, it's a fascinating discovery.
So does this water stay there all the time?
Well, that's a fascinating question, too, and the jury is still out on that. So one interesting thing that they reported was that the water deposits seem to come and go. They seem to see more of the water deposits at sunrise and sunset on the moon than they do during the midday. And nobody really understands how this could be. But it's possible that the sun is somehow heating up the surface enough to let individual water molecules escape, but maybe not all the way out to space. And so the description that I've heard is that maybe these individual water molecules are just hopping along the surface of the moon, so just like doing bunny hops and going up for a few hours and coming back down. And this would explain how water concentrates at the poles, because as this water hops along the moon, as long as it's in a warm region with sunlight, it's going to keep on hopping. But once it gets to one of these permanently shadowed craters, it's going to be stuck there because nothing is going to heat it up, and mm-hmm. It's going to stay in the crater. And so one molecule at a time, these craters are collecting water over billions of years and eventually getting a fairly reasonable amount of water. So even though what we're seeing on the surface is just a very, very, very small amount, it could concentrate at the poles and give you a more useful amount of water.
Hmm. So when you say sunrise and sunset, you mean when the sun rises from the moon's point of view?
Yes.
That's not a 24-hour day.
The lunar day is a month.
Yeah.
It's a month, an Earth month, because as the moon goes around the Earth, it always keeps the same face pointed towards us. But that means it's making one rotation with respect to the sun every month. And so the lunar day lasts something like 27 days.
So these molecules will be evaporated from the surface, in a sense, perhaps over during the day, which lasts
right.
14 Earth days.
Right.
And then at night they cool off and condense back onto the surface.
Right. And particularly, scientists still have to sort out whether this is a real thing that they're seeing or whether it could be some other phenomenon. For example, I heard a talk by one of the scientists on a team who said he thinks that this may just be caused by multiple reflections of the sunlight at sunrise and sunset as it's coming in at a very low angle. The light rays could bounce several times off of the rocks and soil and so forth. And he thinks that maybe that could be mistaken for this sign of water. And, we don't know how the story is going to end, but it's very intriguing while it lasts.
And this is brand new science.
Absolutely. Now, let me tell you about the second mission as well, because this is in some ways even more exciting, which is the LCROSS mission that NASA sent. So this was a mission that was designed to crash a spacecraft into one of these permanently shadowed craters near the South Pole. And the idea was to blow up enough material from from the ground that it will be lifted up into the sort of the vacuum of space and lifted up into the sunlight. Remember, starting from a shadowed crater, so you need to, in order to see this stuff, you need to lift it up into sunlight, and then the sunlight would bounce off of this debris, and again, you'd be able to look for the spectrum of water ice. And so this LCROSS spacecraft did crash into the moon on October 9th this year, and some of your listeners may have heard people talking about, quote, bombing the moon, because the David Letterman show, for example, had a little skit about bombing the moon. And a lot of people, I think, were sort of poking fun at this. But actually, first of all, it wasn't bombing the moon because there's no explosive. It's an empty spacecraft about the size of an SUV that hit the moon at a couple thousand miles an hour. So quite a big impact. I'd say we walloped the moon, but we did not bomb the moon. And the second thing to realize is that this was actually a great experiment, because this is, short of actually going to the moon and landing there and digging, this is the best way to actually get ground truth and actually touch the moon and see if we can actually find the water there. So everything else we've done was from orbit, from 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers high. But this is actually getting down to the ground and seeing what we can excavate. And the exciting thing is that a month later in November, the science team reported its results, and they did see water, and they saw very significant amounts of water.
They found very significant amounts of water in these shadowed polar regions.
That's correct, yeah. So this was in one crater.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about the whole moon. We're not even talking about all the permanently shadowed regions. We've been to one of these regions. It's a crater called Kebeus. This was one that the satellites had identified as a really good, likely target, because they saw a lot of these spectra and reflections that looked like water ice. And so that's why the scientists and the principal scientist is named Tony Colapriet. So he made the decision to go to the Kebeus crater. And so they saw a significant amount of water ice, enough that this, you could really maybe think about starting to use this if you set up a lunar base there.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking today about water on the moon with Dr. Dana McKenzie. Remember our book drawing. Send us your suggestions for future show topics and questions that you would like asked on the air, and you will automatically be entered into the drawing. At the end of the month, we'll pick a winner who will receive a free copy of my book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back talking about the discovery of water on the moon with Dr. Dana McKenzie. So tell us, Dana, why is it important that we discover water on the moon? How is that going to change our lives?
I think it's important in three different ways. So, you know, we've talked for ever since 2004, President George W. Bush announced a vision for space exploration, which involved going back to the moon sort of as a prequel to going on to Mars. And the reason for going to the moon is that it's much closer than Mars, and so you can, you know, gain expertise in your systems and in your astronauts for the much longer, much more dangerous voyage to Mars. So the moon is only 3 days away. Mars is like half a year away, at least. If we do return to the moon, certainly all the lunar scientists would want to go there to stay this time. Because what we did in the 1970s was we sent these, you know, one-time missions to the moon at great expense. And after six of them, we threw up our hands and we said, okay, that's all we care for. And we haven't been back to the moon since, which, you know, scientifically, it's a great tragedy. If we go back to the moon, we'd like to stay. In order to do that, we need to be able to not just get to the moon, but we need to survive there. And we need to not only be able to survive, but we need to thrive. Okay, so there's a guy, a lunar scientist named Paul Spoutis, who likes to use these three words, arrive, survive, and thrive. So we've proved we can arrive at the moon. The next thing we need to do is prove we can survive there. And to survive at the moon, you need water, obviously. You know, you need water to drink. If you want to plant plants, you need water to, you know, to nourish them. So we've got to have a source of water. We also need a source of air. The lunar water can be separated into hydrogen and oxygen. And, of course, the oxygen is what we breathe. So that's also very exciting. And finally, when we get to the point of once we've learned how to survive on the moon, and then we want to thrive on the moon, what does that mean? That means having some sort of lunar economy. So we need a resource that can be exploited, that can be sold, that can encourage private investment in going to the moon. Because, you know, we don't want to shackle, to tie the government down, to tie NASA down to the moon forever. We'd like them to go on to Mars. So it'd be great if we could get private industry, private businesses interested in the moon.
So, Dana, you're saying there's a possibility of making money by going to the moon?
That's right. So the idea would be if we had a permanent space presence, water can be used as a propellant. And the idea is that you separate the water into hydrogen and oxygen. And liquid hydrogen is a great propellant. We use it in our rockets today. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that if you're going to be going to Mars or anywhere else in the solar system, it's much cheaper to send a rocket from the moon than it is to send a rocket from the Earth, because the moon has a much weaker gravitational field. So believe it or not, and I know this will sound amazing to you, but if you're sending a satellite to high Earth orbit, to geostationary orbit, like the satellites we use for GPS, it's cheaper to get that satellite to high Earth orbit from the moon than it is from Earth. So there is actually an economic case that if you could get your fuel from the moon, then the moon would serve as our sort of our gas station in the sky, and we would use it as a place to go to either to high Earth orbit or out into the solar system, to Mars, to asteroids, wherever we want to go. It becomes more economical if you have a fuel source on the moon.
Well, I can certainly understand why that would be true if you wanted to go to an asteroid or to Mars.
Right.
But I'm really surprised to hear that it's easier or cheaper to get to high Earth orbit by going to the moon first. The moon's so much further. Why would...
So I'm assuming you have a base on the moon producing water, and so you don't have to bring that water to the moon. If you can build your satellite on the moon, and if you can give yourself fuel on the moon, then you can send it to high Earth orbit for cheaper than it would be to build it on Earth and to fuel it on Earth.
Okay, so it's cheaper to get from the moon to high Earth orbit.
That's right.
Than it is to get from to high Earth
orbit. Of course, you're right
that
if you're sending something to the moon and then back to Earth, of course that would be more expensive. If you're thinking about a long-term sustainable economy, if we can make our fuel on the moon, maybe make the satellites on the moon too, that probably farther in the future, then that would be a cheaper proposition than actually coming.
What other resources are on the moon besides water?
There's one possibility that has been discussed. Some people think that we might be able to use helium-3, which is found on the moon in great abundance and not found on Earth much at all. The reason that there's this helium-3 on the moon is that the moon is constantly bombarded by solar radiation, and whereas Earth isn't. We have we have an atmosphere that protects us from sort of the hardest parts of the solar radiation. So helium-3 is basically produced by the interaction of the solar wind with the lunar soil or regolith, and so it's been proposed that helium-3 would be a useful resource for a nuclear fusion reactor. There is a wonderful science fiction movie called The Moon, which was actually based on this idea, which the main character was in this robotic facility that produced helium-3 to send back to Earth.
What else would there be on the moon besides helium-3 and water?
L-Cross not only found water, it also found a lot of volatile compounds. There are things like ethanol, methanol, methane, carbon dioxide, ammonia, and so forth. So these are very useful chemicals on Earth and also would be useful on the moon. For example, methane also is a very good rocket propellant, and so fuel up with methane on the moon, and you wouldn't even have to split it. With the water, we'd have to split it into hydrogen and oxygen. With the methane, you can use it as is. So that's very exciting. Also, things like the ammonia. Use the nitrogen and ammonia to, first of all, create a breathable atmosphere, because our atmosphere on Earth is 78% nitrogen. You can also use the nitrogen in fertilizers for the plants that you'd like to grow in a lunar base.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the carbon dioxide would be useful if you want to grow plants right?
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Plants breathe carbon dioxide. That was another of these really surprising findings. L-Cross went to the moon to look for water, and they were expecting, they thought they had a good chance to find it, because there's been enough evidence from orbit that there is water in these permanently shallow craters. But they weren't expecting to find all of these volatile elements, and so that really makes the survival aspect of life on the moon seem much more likely. And also there's lots of great science to be done on why are these volatiles there. For one thing, it makes it much more likely that these ice deposits were delivered by meteoroids and comets, rather than this sort of molecule-at-a-time delivery of water, where the solar wind is bombarding the lunar surface with hydrogen. That hydrogen can hook up with oxygen molecules in the soil and create water. But it does so, one molecule at a time, and those are very small amounts. But if you have a meteoroid hitting the moon or a comet hitting the moon, those have water in them in much greater amounts, and particularly comets have these other volatiles. They're basically dirty ice balls that have carbon dioxide and ammonia and whatnot. So the fact that we're seeing these in this permanently shadowed crater in Cabeus suggests that the water has come, in addition to this one molecule at a time process, there is also water that has come to the moon by cometary or asteroid or meteoroid impacts. And that's exciting because it means that there's likely to be fairly substantial amounts of water.
Do we have a measurement of how much water might be in that crater at the South
Pole?
Well,
that's a great question. And the scientists so far are being very coy about that. So Tony Colapried, I've asked him, he doesn't want to give a number, but he says it's in the range of several percent water. And for context, I'd like to say the water detected by the Indian satellite still makes the moon drier than the driest desert on Earth. But this new finding of L-Cross means that that crater, Cabeus, is actually wetter than the driest desert on Earth. So it's still awfully dry, but we are now talking about something that's sort of Earth standards of dryness. And this means you can practice on Earth. If you want to practice whether you can extract water from this, you know, from the soil on the moon, you could try doing it in the driest deserts on Earth. So I think this is just amazingly exciting.
Are there any materials that we need to survive on the moon that we have determined don't exist there?
That's a good question. Offhand, I can't think of something. I think the thing to realize is that in some ways, the moon is a chunk of Earth mantle. And so that means that a lot of the materials on the moon are the same as materials on Earth. There are different concentrations of them. And so one thing the moon has a lot less of overall is iron. However, paradoxically, on the surface of the moon, there is quite a bit of actual metallic iron in the lunar dust. On Earth, you can't ever find just metallic iron because it rusts immediately in our atmosphere. But on the moon, you could actually take a scoop of lunar dust and it will have little bitty nano-sized iron particles in it. And that dust will actually be magnetic. So you could actually mine iron on the moon just by taking a magnet there and sweeping up the dust. It's an amazing thought. So anyway, I think there's certainly going to be some things that are more convenient to get on Earth than on the moon. Time will tell, really, you know, what are the things that we can best get from the moon and what are the things we'd have to take with us. But the more we can get from the moon, obviously, the better, because it's incredibly expensive to take stuff to the moon. I mean, taking an ounce of anything to the moon costs more than an ounce of gold. So water is worth its weight in gold on the moon, even more. And same with anything else you would want to bring from Earth.
Well, Dana, thank you very much for coming and explaining these exciting discoveries to us. And remember, Dana's book, The Big Splat, or How the Moon Came to Be, is available on Amazon, or it can be ordered from any of the major bookstores. Over the next few shows, we'll be talking about astrophotography, taking images of the heavens. And so I've invited Michael Barber to join us today to talk about an essential part of that effort, which is digital photography with CCD imaging systems. Michael Barber is co-founder and director of the Santa Barbara Instrument Group. Michael, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Be here.
Michael, tell us why CCD imaging has had such a huge impact on astrophotography.
Well, CCDs are relatively new to astrophotography. We started with them about 20 years ago. Before that, film was the primary medium. But CCDs are so much more sensitive than film. They have become the media of choice for astrophotography.
Can you tell us how much more sensitive?
There's a measurement of CCDs in particular. It's called quantum efficiency. Quantum efficiency is defined as the percentage of photons that are striking the device that are actually recorded. So if you can imagine photons from a distant source coming into your telescope and striking the film or the CCD, how many of them can you actually record on film or CCD?
Right.
Hypersensitized film, which is the film that was the astrophotographer's choice prior to CCDs, would record about 10% of the photons that would strike it.
How do CCDs compare to this 10% figure for film?
Today, CCDs that are available to amateurs run in the range of 50% to as high as 80 or 90% quantum efficiency.
Well, that's a huge difference.
It is huge. And they also do not suffer from reciprocity failure. So when you expose for twice the length of time, you do get twice as much light as you would compared to a film exposure where you wouldn't.
Is there any corresponding number that's known for the human eye?
The human eye is less than 5%. It's probably in the 2 to 3% range.
2 to 3% range.
Yeah.
Rather than paying for a telescope that's 2 or 3 or 4 times larger, which is obviously very expensive, replacing the detector with a CCD is a much more cost-effective alternative.
Much more efficient. You can capture, and many amateurs do capture images of objects that they are unable to see at all with their eye.
Yes, I see. Now, one of the things that many people may not understand if they're not used to taking pictures of the heavens is that some of these exposures are very long duration exposures. And the Earth's rotation is an important problem during a long rotation exposure. The sky is continually moving overhead, as it were. So one of the main advantages of your products, as I understand it, is you have something called self-guiding. Michael, could you explain to us what self-guiding means?
You have to imagine in the old days, I mean, a typical picture that you take of kids at the beach is a fraction of a second, but the objects in the sky at night are very, very dim. The analogy is that you often hear is trying to take a picture of a black cat in a coal mine. You have to expose for a very, very long period of time in order to capture as much light as you can from the object in space. And in the old days, the way you would do it is you had a high-powered eyepiece, like a microscope eyepiece, and you'd put a star on a crosshair, and you'd sit there for an hour or so or longer with a paddle in your hand, and if the star moved ever so slightly off the crosshair, you would nudge it back, because telescope drives, even the best ones available to amateurs, are not good enough to track something so perfectly that it will stay exactly in the right spot on the film during an hour-long exposure. The telescope has to move at exactly that same rate, but in a smoothness that is extraordinary. We try to keep an object, say, centered on a crosshair to within about an arc second of accuracy. Now, to try to imagine how wide an arc second is, think of someone holding a dime standing about 2 miles away. So you need your telescope to track something that small over a period of an hour while it's moving. It's a very difficult thing to do. So people's backs were sore and their necks were sore and it would be cold and they'd fall asleep. And, you know, in the middle of an exposure, someone would bump the telescope and they'd lose the image. And it was a real nightmare trying to take very, very long exposures with film until CCDs came along. And in fact, our first product was not a camera, but a guider meant to guide film exposures. And what it did was it would put a little star on a crosshair on the CCD, and the CCD would notice whether it moved, and it would automatically issue a command to the telescope to correct its motion. Those are still used to guide the largest telescopes, film cameras, and other CCD cameras, but what our innovation was and what we did was we put one of those inside the CCD cameras that we make, so one camera does both. It'll take the image. At the same time, another CCD inside the camera is guiding the telescope.
And it's guiding the telescope by sending electronic signals to the motor system of the telescope to adjust the angle that it's aiming at.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's wonderful. How long have you guys been in business?
Well, we started about 20 years ago in a garage. We got together because we were a group of amateurs who were monitoring gamma ray bursts. Error boxes. We were trying to discover an optical counterpart to a gamma ray burst back when little was known about them. And we had to watch these error boxes all night long with our telescopes. And we couldn't keep our telescopes trained on this area of the sky all night without going out constantly and correcting it by hand.
That sounds like a very ambitious project for some amateur photographers.
Well, it was, but it was the kind of thing that was, it wasn't the larger observatories weren't able to dedicate that kind of time to just staring at empty space to see if they could find something. So it was perfect for us.
Mm-hmm.
But we needed something to guide the telescopes while we slept so that because we all had to get up and work the next day. So
one of the difficulties of being an astronomer, right?
That's right.
Right. Okay, that's great. Michael, thank you very much. And thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guide to thecosmos.com. Goodbye.